eKatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So today we're digging into, well, a truly remarkable document. It's the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Now that title, it sounds pretty final, doesn't it? Maybe even a bit morbid.
It really does, yeah. But that's actually a bit of a mistranslation that just kind of stuck over time. The original Egyptian title, Runu Peret Emheru, translates more closely to the Book of Coming Forth by Day.
Coming Forth by Day. That changes everything, doesn't it?
Completely. It shifts the whole perspective. It's not about death itself, but about, you know, rebirth, emergence into light.
Okay, so that reframing is crucial. This isn't some gloomy guide to dying. It's more like a spiritual roadmap, a guide on how to actually conquer death.
Exactly. It's one of humanity's earliest and maybe most detailed attempts to chart that journey of the soul after death. It tackles that huge question. What do I need? What knowledge? What moral standing? What preparation is required to get through death and live forever?
And their answer wasn't simple, was it?
Not at all. For the ancient Egyptians, death wasn't, you know, just an end point. It wasn't rest. It was the start of this really perilous journey, a high-stakes spiritual voyage through the underworld, the Duat.
High stakes indeed. And you needed things to survive it.
Absolutely. You needed knowledge, specific magical protections, and maybe most importantly, you needed to have lived a life that was, well, morally sound.
Yeah.
Ethically aligned.
Right. So for a journey like that, you definitely want a good guide. But who actually wrote this? You said it wasn't just one person.
No, not at all. And that's part of what makes it so compelling, I think. It's a collective work, totally anonymous, compiled over, get this, like 1,500 years of Egyptian history.
1,500 years. So who were these authors?
Generations of them. Scribes, priests, theologians, basically the guardians of sacred knowledge at the time.
The keepers of the secrets.
Pretty much. They were the ones who took texts that were initially just for royalty. You know, the pyramid texts found in Pharaoh's tombs and later texts for nobles, the coffin texts, and they sort of codified them, made them more accessible, though still expensive and exclusive for a long time.
And their authority came from more than just tradition.
Oh, definitely. It was deeply tied to their mastery of hieroglyphs. They believed the script itself, the act of writing these sacred words, held real creative power, magical power. They called it hika.
Hika. So writing the spells wasn't just recording them.
It was activating them, participating in the magic needed for the deceased to actually make the journey. So this book, it really holds the collective wisdom, the deepest fears, and also the highest hopes of an entire civilization.
Wow. So we're tapping into the spiritual consciousness of ancient Egypt here.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the core goal? What was the book for, practically speaking?
Well, think of it as a highly personalized divine roadmap. It's a collection of spells, hymns, instructions, all designed to empower the soul of the deceased, which we call the Ba, your personality aspect.
Right, the Ba.
To navigate all the obstacles waiting in the underworld, the Duat. And the ultimate aim, to achieve this transfigured eternal state, to become an Ankh, a blessed spirit.
Okay, so it's a toolkit for the soul's journey. But it sounds like just having the book wasn't enough.
Yeah.
You mentioned morality. What were the actual requirements for success?
Yeah, absolutely critical. They were very clear. Eternal life wasn't a given. It had to be earned. There were basically three main requirements, non-negotiable ones.
Okay, what are they?
First, like we touched on, you absolutely had to have lived a morally upright life on Earth. A life in accordance with Maat, that's truth, balance, cosmic order.
Maat, that seems fundamental. What's second?
Second, you needed mastery of the sacred knowledge in the book. You had to know the right spells, the right passwords, the names of the gods and demons you'd meet.
Knowledge is power.
Yeah.
Literally.
Literally. And third, you had to successfully pass the final judgment, a divine tribunal.
Okay, so pass those three tests.
Hmm.
And then what? Where does the soul end up?
If you succeed, you're reborn into the field of reeds. The Egyptians called it Aru.
The field of reeds. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Imagine the most perfect, idealized version of Egypt itself. Eternal spring, bountiful harvest without end, peace. And you live there in bliss among the gods themselves. That was the goal.
Sounds pretty good. All right, let's get into the journey itself. You mentioned the book follows the soul's path, right, chronologically.
That's right, yeah. It's structured by the stages of the journey, which makes sense. The first parts deal with the immediate challenges right after death in the tomb.
Okay, so what's step one?
Step one is basically reanimation, getting the deceased functional again, spiritually speaking. That's section one, often called coming forth by day. It's about restoring the senses.
And isn't there a specific ritual for that, the opening of the mouth?
Exactly. Spell 23 details the opening of the mouth ceremony. It was performed on the mummy itself, or sometimes a statue. It was absolutely vital.
Why vital? What did it do?
Magically, it restored the ability to see, to speak, to eat, drink, and move. It allowed the bath, your soul personality, to leave the tomb, interact with the world, and return to the body without it. Well, the fear was being trapped, conscious but paralyzed forever inside the mummy.
Okay, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
So opening the mouth gets you mobile. Then you face the underworld, the Duat.
Then comes the Duat, yes. Section 2 is basically your arsenal for surviving it. And you needed an arsenal. The texts describe it as a really dangerous place. Fiery lakes, terrifying demons, snakes, crocodiles.
Sounds rough. What's your main weapon in there?
Knowledge. Specifically, the knowledge contained in the spells. These incantations are your magical toolkit. They ward off monsters, quench fire, and crucially, they contain the secret names.
Secret names of what?
Of the gatekeepers, the guardians of various portals and realms within the Duat. If you approached a gate and didn't know the guardian's true secret name...
You couldn't get through.
Exactly. You were just stuck. It was at a series of high-stakes password challenges.
Wow. There's also that spell about the heart, right? Spell 30B, the one with the scarab. That feels really personal.
Oh, the heart scarab spell. Yes, spell 30B. It's profoundly personal. The heart, for Egyptians, wasn't about emotion like we think of it. It was the seat of intelligence, memory, and crucially, conscience.
The conscience.
Right. So this scarab amulet, inscribed with the spell, was placed over the mummy's heart. And the spell is basically an appeal to your own heart, your own conscience. It pleads, oh, my heart, do not stand up against me as a witness.
You're literally asking your conscience not to betray you at the final judgment. That speaks volumes about their psychology, their understanding of guilt.
It really does. It shows this deep awareness of inner accountability. And beyond just defense, some spells gave you, well, superpowers almost.
Transformation.
Transformation. How so? Yes, spells that let the soul change shape. You could become a falcon to, you know, fly over obstacles, or a swallow, a serpent, even a lotus flower blooming from the primordial waters, a powerful symbol of rebirth.
Okay, so you navigate the dangers,
yeah,
armed with spells and transformations. Then comes the climax, right? Section
yes.
3, the judgment.
This is it, the main event. It takes place in the Hall of Two Truths, presided over by Osiris, the god of the underworld. Mm-hmm. And it all revolves around spell 125. This is really the moral core of the whole book.
Spell 125, what happens there?
This is the famous weighing of the heart ceremony. The deceased person's heart, their conscience, their life's record is placed on one side of a huge scale.
And on the other side?
The feather of Matat, that single ostrich feather representing truth, justice, cosmic order, everything that's right.
Wow. And the soul has to speak up here too, don't they? The negative confession.
Yes, exactly. It's not a passive process. The deceased stands before Osiris and 42 other divine judges, and they have to recite this declaration of innocence, the negative confession.
What kinds of things do they confess not doing?
It's fascinatingly comprehensive. It covers the big things. Obviously, I have not killed, I have not stolen. But it also includes much more subtle social and ethical points. Things like, I have not gossiped. I have not been arrogant. I have not eavesdropped. I have not caused pain to others. I have not polluted the water.
So it's a really sophisticated code of conduct, covering personal behavior, social harmony, even environmental respect in a way.
Absolutely. It shows a deep understanding of what makes a just and balanced society, all tied to individual responsibility.
And the stakes, if your heart is heavier than the feather, if you fail the test.
The consequences are, well, absolute and final. Your heart, heavy with sin, is immediately thrown to the floor and devoured by this terrifying creature waiting beside the scales. Her name is Amit.
Amit the Devourer.
Right. She's depicted as this monstrous hybrid, part crocodile, part lion, part hippopotamus, the most terrifying predators known to Egyptians, all rolled into one. And if she eats your heart, that's it. Complete annihilation. Utter oblivion. Not hell, just non-existence, which for the Egyptians was the most dreadful fate imaginable, to cease to be.
But if your heart balances, if it's light as the feather,
then you are declared Makaru, truer voice, justified, vindicated. You've passed the ultimate test.
And then you get to proceed to section 4, vindication in paradise.
Exactly. Now you're cleared for entry into the field of reeds, Aru. Spell 110, for instance, describes this paradise in detail.
What's it like again?
It's depicted as this perfect, fertile land. You're granted your own plot, eternal food, eternal peace. But Here's maybe the best part for an agricultural society.
Mm.
You don't actually have to do the farming yourself.
Wait, really? How does that work?
Remember those little figurines they put in the tombs? The Shabtai figure?
Oh, right, the little servant statues?
Hundreds of them sometimes. The spells in the Book of the Dead magically animate these Shabtis in the afterlife. Their entire job is to answer the call whenever manual labor is needed, plowing, sowing, reaping, and do it for the deceased.
So eternal bliss includes having magical servants do all the work. That is definitely paradise.
For them, it certainly was perpetual abundance without the endless toil.
Okay, stepping back from the narrative itself, what are the big takeaways here? The major themes that maybe still resonate. The first one seems unavoidable, this idea of Matt, moral order.
Oh, absolutely. That's the bedrock. The entire system hinges on it. Your eternal destiny depends fundamentally on your character, on how you lived your life on Earth. It wasn't just about having the money for a fancy tomb or the right spells.
So it's earned, not bought, at least in theory.
In theory, yes. The universe, according to this view, rewards balance and ethical living. So the reflection for us maybe is pretty direct. Are my actions, my words creating balance? Would my metaphorical heart be light?
That's a challenging thought. Okay, theme number two seems to be about knowledge, the power of words, names, spells, that Hika concept again.
Definitely. The journey through the Duat is presented almost like a series of knowledge tests, isn't it? Knowing the right words, the right names, gives you power over the dangers.
So knowledge literally overcomes fear and obstacles.
Precisely. And there's a parallel for us there, I think. Recognizing how understanding something, naming it, knowing the details, it reduces anxiety, it gives us a sense of control. Think about preparing for a job interview or a difficult conversation. Knowledge is preparation, and preparation reduces fear. Using intentional language, maybe like affirmations, can also be seen as a modern form of Hika, using words to shape reality.
That's interesting. And a third theme, the sheer amount of structure, gates, guardians, judges, confessions,
Yeah.
it feels almost bureaucratic.
It does, doesn't it? That's a great observation. The afterlife journey mirrors the highly organized hierarchical structure of the ancient Egyptian state. They were mapping the terrifying unknown onto the familiar structures of their own world.
Dealing with the cosmic by making it feel like dealing with, well, the government.
Kind of, yeah. It's a way of managing cosmic anxiety, giving it rules, stages, procedures. And maybe the lesson for us is that we can reduce our own anxiety about big unknowns like retirement or a major career change, or even just uncertainty by creating our own roadmaps, breaking it down, preparing our paperwork, both practically and emotionally. Structure can be comforting.
Okay, let's pull out some specific lines or ideas that really capture the essence of the book, those key incantations or declarations.
Sure. Well, you have to start with the core of the negative confession from spell 125, something like, I have not committed sin against people. I have not gossiped. I have not done what the gods detest.
That really covers both the moral action and the ritual propriety, doesn't it? What the gods approve of.
Exactly, and encapsulates that dual requirement. Then there's that incredibly raw plea from the heart scarab spell 30b. Oh, my heart, do not stand up against me as a witness.
It's so vulnerable. Facing your own conscience as the ultimate judge, the fear that your inner self might condemn you, it's powerful.
It really shows their psychological depth. And then maybe on the other end, the declaration of triumph, identifying with the sun god Ra, the ultimate symbol of rebirth. I am yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and I have the power to be born a second time.
That's not just asking for eternal life, that's claiming divinity almost,
Yeah.
claiming power over time itself.
It's the ultimate statement of having succeeded, of becoming one with the eternal cycle.
So, thinking about practical applications for us today,
Yeah.
how can we use these ancient ideas? You mentioned the negative confession as a sort of ethical inventory.
Yeah, I think that's maybe the most direct application. Imagine creating a personal negative confession. What are the things we shouldn't be doing in our modern lives?
Okay, like what?
Well, adapting it. I have not spread misinformation online. I have not ignored suffering I could have alleviated. I have not acted out of prejudice. I have not wasted resources carelessly, things relevant to our ethical landscape.
The point isn't achieving perfection, right?
Yeah.
It's about the effort.
Exactly. It's about cultivating that conscious ethical life, constantly checking in, trying to keep that metaphorical heart light. It's about intention and ongoing effort.
And the other big takeaway seemed to be about preparation.
Yes. The sheer effort and resources Egyptians put into preparing for death in the afterlife is astounding. For us, maybe that translates into preparing for major life transitions or even the end of life with similar intention.
How so?
Well, it means not leaving things unsaid. Healing relationships where possible, thinking about the legacy we want to leave, getting our affairs, both practical and emotional, in order, facing the unknown, not with denial, but with clarity and preparation, much like the Book of the Dead aimed to provide.
So, wrapping up, what was the most surprising or striking thing for you revisiting this text?
For me, I think it's how fundamentally life-affirming it actually is, despite the name we usually call it. It's this powerful assertion of the human will to endure, to overcome even death itself. And it insists that the foundation for that endurance is a life lived well, ethically. Also, the absolute importance they placed on the physical body, the mummy, as the anchor for the soul. That link was crucial.
Yeah, that's fascinating. For me, what really stood out this time is that connection you mentioned between individual morality and cosmic order, Mat. It's this grand vision where your personal ethical choices ripple outwards and affect the balance of the entire universe. It provides this this powerful blueprint suggesting that knowledge, preparation, and living righteously are the keys to transforming fear, uncertainty, even death, into a manageable, navigable journey.
A journey, not just an end. That's the key, isn't it?
Exactly. It turns the ultimate fear into the soul's greatest adventure.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.